Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, when the 11th Armored Division of the American Army discovered the Mauthausen concentration camp in May 1945, how many Spanish prisoners did they find there? George Sherman was 17 years old when he enlisted in the U.S. Army in 1944. He fought in the Battle of the Bulge that winter, and in May 1945 was a tank gunner in the 11th Armored Division. They were in northern Austria looking for the Russian soldiers they were supposed to meet when they came upon Mauthausen concentration camp, which they hadn't known existed. His unit drove into the camp and stopped, seeing the barracks, the dead bodies, and the surviving prisoners. They radioed back to headquarters, and their officers joined them shortly afterward. It took decades for Sherman to speak about the experience, and now he has made it his mission to educate younger generations about the Holocaust, speaking to school and community groups around the world, and also participating in teacher training programs. In 2010, Sherman, along with more than 100 other former U.S. soldiers who liberated Nazi death camps during World War II, were honored at a special ceremony in Washington. Sherman told us about the day they found Mauthausen, and also about what he's doing now to ensure that what happened then will never happen again. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, George. You enlisted in the Army when you were 18. You weren't drafted. Why did you enlist in the Army?
I had three of my older brothers were already in the service, and I was actually 17. I was 1 month away from being 18, and I wanted to choose the branch of service rather than be drafted. And I enlisted with the idea of getting into the Air Force, which at that time was called the Air Corps. Being a 17-year-old senior in high school, I figured the Air Force had the prettiest uniforms, and all the girls would like that. As it turned out, I was colorblind, and I did not get into the Air Force, but I was still in the Army, and they sent me to Fort Knox, Kentucky, where they trained me as a heavy tank gunner in the Armored Command. And that's how I got there. And after training, I was then sent to a small outpost in Arkansas for special training on small arms. And then eventually in December of 1944, I found myself on a troop ship going to Le Havre, France. I was in the 11th Armored Division and in the 41st Cavalry, which was a reconnaissance patrol. It did not have any horses. We had tanks and jeeps, etc. Unfortunately, when I landed, it was just at the start of the Battle of the Bulge, and that was a pretty tough indoctrination into the Army. It was an awful winter. The Germans really did a number on the American troops. In fact, statistically, in a three-week period, over 80,000 Americans were either killed, wounded, or captured in this horrible offensive by the Germans. It also had another repercussion that set the end of the war back by over a month. If it didn't happen, the war would have been over in April instead of May. And a byproduct of that was that in those 30 days, we find that an additional few hundred thousand Jews and non-Jews were killed in the camps.
Let me ask you about that, because you were on some sort of a patrol and discovered the Mauthausen camp. Can you tell us how that happened?
Right. After the Battle of the Bulge, the division fought through France and Germany, and on May 3rd, we captured Linz, Austria. And Linz, Austria, happened to be also the birthplace of Adolf Hitler. On the 5th of May, after receiving new uniforms and hot food and showers and whatnot, being a reconnaissance platoon, we were ordered to go east to find the Russians who were somewhere near Vienna. And we left on May 5th on a very nice warm day, looking for the Russians, and about 7 kilometers outside of Linz, we started to smell an awful odor, which we couldn't identify, and within a few more kilometers, we had seen on the left side of the road what appeared to be, in America, we would call it a stockade, two big stone towers joined by big, heavy wooden doors. Radiating out of those doors were barbed wire fences. And anyway, our patrol sergeant ordered us in to the camp. We brought up one of the tanks to break down the door, and we entered the camp.
Were there still Germans there?
We didn't know that. That was part of the problem. When we entered the camp, you have to remember we were on a combat patrol. And when we entered and we saw what we saw, we came to an immediate stop. There was quite something we never expected. But we knew, had the presence of mind, that we, with the jeeps, these were machine gun jeeps, we radiated quickly through the camp as fast as we could, thinking that there might be still Germans. For the most part, they had left the day before, knowing we were right there in the vicinity. There were 6 or 7 guards, German guards, still there that the prisoners identified. These guards had changed their German uniforms for the typical striped pajama uniform. But the prisoners identified them and dispatched them, including, by the way, the camp commandant, which was surprising that he didn't leave. But anyway, they were gone. There were no Germans that we knew of. They had brought in local police from Mauthausen, the town of Mauthausen, or whatnot, who quickly just threw up their hands. They didn't want to get involved in any of that.
Did you know who the prisoners were?
No, we did not know. When you say the prisoners, you're talking about the inmates of the... but we identified quickly, I mean, that we knew there were thousands. They were not all Jews. They were, I would say, by the time we got the information, half of the camp were non-Jewish. We also found 3,000 Spanish prisoners in the camp.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about them, because the Spanish Republicans who escaped and became exiled after Franco won, a lot of them ended up in Mauthausen.
We didn't know it at the time, but we identified them. They were dressed differently. They had not regular clothes, but they were fully clothed. They were not walking skeletons, which we had found most of the prisoners were severely malnutrition. They were walking skeletons. And typically, as you know, there were piles of bodies. The barracks were filled with dead prisoners in there. The crematory, there were 6 ovens in Mauthausen. They were still warm. There's a gas chamber. There's a gallows room, and there was a killing wall, all which we had found. We were in 6 hours that we were in the camp. You have to remember, when we entered the camp, we were just 27 men. We were a platoon. We were 25 soldiers and 2 combat medics, and we had 3 jeeps and 3 tanks. Our mission was a combat patrol to find the Russians. This we didn't know. Anyway, we did offer all of our rations to the prisoners, which was the wrong thing to do. They couldn't handle the food. We didn't know that. We, of course, when we entered the camp, we radioed back to the division who was in Linz, and they finally came up full-blown. They brought medics and an engineer battalion, which started to dig graves to bury the bodies, etc.
Did you know anything beforehand about the extermination camps?
The only thing we knew was, initially we heard in January of 45, the Russians liberated most of the camps in Poland. And that was the first time that there were pictures and descriptions of the camps. We were heavily involved in combat during that time, really didn't take too much notice of it. But in April, for the first time, the American Army, the Third Army, liberated Buchenwald. Mm-hmm. And that was the big open press photographers, newsreel cameras, et cetera. And under General Eisenhower, he required as many troops, American troops, to go through the camp just to be witnesses in the future. He very wisely predicted that there would be people later on who would say it never happened. By doing this, there were over 1 million American soldiers who went through different camps as they were being liberated, and they became additional witnesses in addition to the survivors, of course.
You were a kid at the time. You were, what, 18 years old. That must have been really quite a shock. And nowadays, you know, we hear a lot about post-traumatic stress. I don't think that in those days anybody talked about that kind of thing. How did you handle this?
Well, remember, we came through, I came through about 6 months of combat. So we have seen death. This was combat death. And we have seen towns that were completely crumbled by Air Force bombings and artillery. So we've seen millions of, not millions, but a load of people killed in combat. This was different. This here was pure murder, what it came down to. And it was difficult. But at the time, because you're in combat, it doesn't register. It took, in our case, I would say it took about 2 weeks after leaving the camp to finally let it sink in what the heck was going on there and why and how. Didn't talk about it after getting out of the Army for about 50 years. And most soldiers, if you would speak to them, never talked about any of their experiences. This goes on to this present day. The Vietnam vets do not talk about it. Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. And that's a shame because people should ask them, let them get it out, you know. In my case, my brothers who served in the, did not ever go overseas, but were in the armed forces, never asked me. I have no remembrance of my parents ever asking me any of my experiences.
Well, that's also been the case with a lot of survivors of the Holocaust, that if they spoke about it at all, it took them decades to speak about it. What made you decide to speak about it?
Well, just by a good coincidence, about 7 years ago, I met accidentally a gentleman who was a survivor of Mauthausen. He lived in my community. I lived down in Boca Raton, Florida. He lived there. We were, you know, just a half a mile apart, but never knew each other. And when we did meet and identified that I was a liberator of the camp and he was in the camp, he was a very strong believer in the March of the Living. I don't know if you know that program, but of the March of the Living. And he was very outspoken. He did speak about the camps. And we would meet every week for lunch. And he would keep after me that I should tell the story. And lo and behold, we started to talk to school children, synagogues, etc., side by side. He'd tell his side of the story, I would tell my side. And he got me really to get involved.
How old are the children who you speak to at the schools?
Generally, they're from the middle school. They're about from 13 through 18. Once in a blue moon, you would get a younger, a little bit younger, 11, 12. But I also speak to adults. And Florida having a very large amount of survivors, mostly right now they're child survivors. They were 11, 12, 13-year-olds in the camps who are now in their upper 70s, 80s. So a lot of times I will be speaking with them also. But I also speak to them. And their memory is a lot different than the senior survivors, you know, who lived through it. But when you ask about why didn't the survivors talk about it, from their end of it, this is a guilt situation. They made it. It wasn't a happy situation to talk about. And I think they came to the realization that they were witnesses, and if they didn't do it, it would be lost. But that is how I got involved.
When you speak to these kids, how much do they know about World War II or the Holocaust or any of these things? I mean, and what is their reaction?
Well, the younger, when you're the middle school, these are 13, 14, 15-year-old children. They know of it and they don't know of it. They really have no idea. When I speak to them, the boys, of course, I try to speak to them, by the way, wearing my uniform. So the boys, of course, military, you know, they're interested in the medals and the blah, blah, blah. So, you know. But we can see by the expressions on their faces that they really don't know about it, but they're hearing about it for the first time. And we're encouraged by the fact that afterwards, a lot of them are required to write some kind of a composition or whatnot, and they do send me copies of that. So I'm gratified to know that it does get across. The older ones, the senior high school, these are 17, 18, they kind of equate when I let them know in my talking that I was their age when this was happening. And they show quite a good interest in that. And I think they get a little more schooling in World War II and the Holocaust. Unfortunately, there's no way to measure, you know, what the results are. So we keep doing it. The Holocaust Museum in Washington sponsors me on a lot of these talks. The Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton has an endowed chair to teach the Holocaust. And the state of Florida, which is one of the few states in the United States that mandate the teaching of the Holocaust, the Florida University, they have developed the syllabus on how to teach the Holocaust to the children. So I do speak a lot of times to the teachers about twice a year. And not only me, but there are other witnesses, both on the survivor side and the liberating side. So the teachers get a rough idea, and they develop just how far you can go with the children. You can't get too graphic with the young ones. The old ones understand it. And sometimes we supplement the talks with excerpts from different movies. Schindler's List, The Band of Brothers has some elements of it. So I think the word gets out.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because now, for the last couple of generations anyway, the military has been voluntary in the United States. And so there isn't this culture that everybody gets drafted and everybody does their couple of years or whatever, even in peacetime. And I'm just wondering how kids nowadays of that age can relate to what went on then and to the fact that everybody was in the military.
Well, you know, you raise a very good point, because I do point it out when I speak to the adults. It is probably the last war, the Second World War, that the American population supported the war. We paid for it. They raised the taxes. We had rationing of food, gasoline, etc. The whole country was involved in it. All the subsequent wars, we didn't pay for it. We're passing it on to our grandchildren. You look around, there's nobody suffering but the soldiers, which is a shame. So how they equate it, we tell them that. So the young people, I don't know if it registers yet. Politically, maybe it's a little too early for them to put two and two together.
Well, because World War II was supported not just financially, but also politically and emotionally by the American people, whereas the Vietnam War wasn't, for example. And I think a lot of the soldiers who came back from Vietnam suffered even more because of that.
True. I happen to have a very good friend who is a Vietnam. He was a helicopter pilot. He was shot down. He lost a leg in the crash. And I've recently been speaking to him about it. They feel that the American people disrespects them, and it's an awful thing. They did their duty. It was the politicians who didn't do it. They were drafted, for the most part, and they honored their country by serving. They did their job. It was the politicians who got them into this that they shouldn't have. And I think the American people are first starting to realize that and giving those veterans the due credit they deserve. Yes.
Is there anything else you would like to add that we might have left out?
I firmly believe that it should be taught constantly. I have recently came up, it in my head this last Passover. And it kind of reminded me that, I don't know, for 5,000-6,000 years, every Passover we tell the story of the Exodus, which is very important, and the children hear it every year, every year. And I think we ought to include in Passover the Holocaust, because if we don't keep telling the children as they grow up, it's going to fade away. And the slogan of never again, and then that was enhanced to never again to us, and every year they keep enhancing the slogan. But you look around and politically you see genocide happening in other countries, and you often wonder, and recently you hear of the killings in a synagogue or other anti-Semitic type of actions. So if we don't keep reminding the young people of what happened and what could happen, we're not doing our job.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSephirah.com. See you next week.